Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, from early hunter-gatherer tribes to current systems, we'll explore how societies and political systems developed and how and why they decay. Then on the Scholar Circle, what are the trends and the consequences of an increasingly unequal society? How did society develop from bands of hunter and gatherers to our current political systems? Where did the concepts of accountability come from, and why did a swell of democracies then follow with a decline in democratic gains? What is behind political decay? These are the questions posed by our next guest, Francis Fukuyama, in his book, The Origins of Political Order, From Pre-Human Times to the French Revolution. So welcome, Francis Fukuyama. Welcome to The Insiders.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you with us. You know, I think I wanted to start with big picture that you painted at the beginning of your book, The Origins of Political Order, and that deals with this surge in democracies. You noted that during the 40-year period from 1970 to 2010, there were quite a few more democracies established, and starting even in 1973, you said only 45 were free. So how do we measure this, and tell us more about what happened in that time frame?
Well, this phenomenon has been called the third wave of democratization, the third big expansion of the number of democracies that we've seen since the French and American revolutions. And it was quite remarkable. The peak of this really probably was right at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall, when all of these countries in Eastern Europe gave up communism and became liberal democracies. And I think historically that was a remarkable thing, but in many respects it's been disappointing because many of these new democracies managed to have elections. They went through the motions of having democratic institutions, but the substance of democracy was oftentimes not there. I think the best example of this is Russia, which under Vladimir Putin has managed to jail or kill journalists, suppress really any opposition, serious opposition forces, and in other ways to stifle dissent. And so they do hold elections. Mr. Putin is in some sense legitimately a leader of that country, but it's not what we would call a successful liberal democracy. And so the origin of this book, in a way, was to try to understand where these basic institutions come from that are the foundation of what we would label a modern political order, and in some sense to indicate to people how, although we have this miracle of the third wave, that we still have a long way to go.
So you talked also about these reversal of democratic gains that also occurred in the early 2000s. What happened?
Well, for example, in December 2004, in Ukraine, there was a stolen election. A former communist president managed to get himself reelected by fraud. There was the Orange Revolution, this mobilization, very similar to what we've seen in the Arab world, in the Arab Spring, where masses of people came out to protest. And in fact, they staged another election that was monitored internationally. It was free and fair, and a much more democratic candidate, Mr. Yushchenko, was then elected president. But in the succeeding years, as a result, I think, of incompetence and high levels of corruption and basically poor leadership, the Orange Coalition, so-called Orange Coalition, fell apart. And today, Ukraine is again run by the very same president, Viktor Yanukovych, that stole that election back in 2004. And so I think it's an important caution that although we see these surges in favor of democracy and against authoritarian government, getting to an actual successful democracy is not always that easy.
You mentioned that there was a post-authoritarian gray zone. Is that what you're describing now, or are you talking about exact reversals? And if they're not the same thing, what do you mean by the gray zone?
Well, I think that you do see real reversals. So Venezuela under Hugo Chavez has basically dismantled many important institutions of accountability, the free media, an independent court system. And so it really barely qualifies as a democracy today. In other cases, I think we were simply wrong about the direction that some of these countries were headed. So you have these countries in Central Asia that had been part of the Soviet Union, like Kazakhstan, which hold elections, but rather than transitioning to full liberal democracy, I think are stuck in a kind of gray zone where they seem to be quite happy to be semi-democratic, semi-authoritarian. So there's a wide variety, I think, of outcomes around the world.
One that you pointed out was in India, where you mentioned that it is a successful democracy, but the legislators, about a third of them, are under some form of criminal indictment.
Well, not only that, it's like making sausages. You know, the closer you look at Indian democracy, in a sense, the less appealing it is, because many Indian politicians mobilize voters and get people to vote for them based on what political scientists call patronage or clientelism, where basically you're sort of bribing your constituents to vote, or else people are voting on very narrow caste or ethnic or sectarian lines. Hindus or Muslims or people of untouchables will simply vote for a candidate because that candidate promises to not to put into place broad public policy programs that benefit everybody, but simply programs that benefit that narrow group of people that supported them. And so I think that we have to put this in perspective, because a lot of American politics work like that.
I was just going to say, isn't that kind of pervasive across many political systems?
It's pervasive. And I think one of the great elements of what we would label political modernization or political development is to move from a system in which politics is all about patronage and clientelism to one that is based on larger and more impersonal kinds of political issues. But you're absolutely right. The U.S. Congress continues to dole out favors to special interest groups. It's a little bit more sophisticated than what happens in India, but a lot of the impulse is very much the same.
One of the things you wrote about in your book, The Origins of Political Order, dealt with some of the aspects of decay. And you talked about polarization, and you talked about also disparities, big income disparities and that sort of a thing that we're starting to see more and more of in the U.S. And then, of course, you mentioned Hugo Chavez. Now, a lot of people believe that he is actually managing to reduce the disparities, particularly economically. Wouldn't that in some ways support a stronger kind of institutional democratic form?
It is true that he's used oil money to start a number of social programs for poor people, and that's perfectly legitimate. I think most Latin American governments don't do enough in this regard. And in fact, one of the reasons that he's gotten support from the poor in Venezuela is precisely because he's shown that he cares about them. But he's also a patronage politician, because he'll give these kinds of programs basically to people that support them and deny them to people that don't support them. And I think that, you know, democracy is not just a matter of having social programs and giving favors to people. It's a whole set of institutions that limit power and make it predictable. What the rule of law is a set of rules that the president of the country feels he has to obey. And Chavez has been busy jailing justices and packing the Supreme Court with people that agree with him, and jailing the ones that don't. That's why a real democracy, it consists of three separate institutions. You have to have a state that's strong enough and powerful enough to be able to enforce laws, but it also needs to be limited by a rule of law, and it needs to have some genuine form of democratic accountability. And getting that balance, I think, is the real trick in the miracle of modern politics.
Are there any shining star examples? I ask this partly because you talk about democracy's failures and that they really occur in the execution, and that many authoritarians pretend to be Democrats. Is everybody pretending to some degree? Is it all just kind of relative?
Well, no, I think that there are some genuine successes. If you look at many of the former communist countries, you know, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Slovenia, the Baltic states, all of them not only made the transition into functioning democracies, they did it much faster. They got into the European Union. They're all members of NATO. And so that has been quite a successful transition. It's not culturally specific to Europe. Taiwan and South Korea both made democratic transitions in the past generation. And what's remarkable in Latin America, actually democracy is doing very well. You had three presidents who stepped down after two full terms, and they left with popularity ratings in the 70s and 80s, something that an American president would kill for. This was Uribe in Colombia, Lula in Brazil, and Bachelet in Chile. And so I think actually in Latin America, democracy is actually very, very healthy at the moment.
Now, you've talked about in the book how important political institutions are, and you've compared societies that do and don't have these institutions or strong government. Talk about the roles of institutions and what it looks like with and without them.
Well, there is an example of why institutions are important that occurred in this election, Peru. So Peru is democracy. It's actually been growing very rapidly based on commodity exports, minerals and agriculture and so forth. But it's not a happy country, and it's a very poorly institutionalized one. And among the missing institutions are political parties. And so you had a presidential election where basically anyone can run for president. You don't have to be supported by a party. And in fact, there are no parties that can organize, let's say, like the Republicans and Democrats do, or the conservatives and the Labour Party in Britain, you know, into real choices. And what ended up happening was the bulk of Peruvians probably would have supported a centrist government, but the centrist vote was split between two individuals. And as a result, you had a kind of right-wing candidate, the daughter of Alberto Fujimori, who had been a dictator, actually, in the 1990s, and a left-wing candidate that was a supporter of Hugo Chavez, Ollanta Humala. And the result is a terrible choice. Eventually, Humala won by a tiny margin, but it was about as unhappy a democratic choice as you could have imagined. And this is why you need political parties. If you don't have parties to organize people and give them information about what kind of policies people are going to support, you're not going to have rational choices. Incidentally, this is one of the big challenges right now in countries like Tunisia and Egypt, which have gotten rid of their authoritarian rulers. If they do not develop coherent political parties, they are going to fall subject to exactly the same kind of problem.
So you think that political parties are really key in facilitating democratic governance?
Well, you take a country like Egypt. At the moment, the two best organized forces in the country are the military and the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamist party that is probably, you know, not really committed to democracy in Egypt. And it could be that a majority of Egyptians would actually prefer a much more Western-oriented, liberal type of regime that's not rooted in religion or Islam or anything else, but they don't have powerful political parties. And the Muslim Brotherhood will be the leading party, not because it represents a majority of Egyptians, but just because you don't have a well-institutionalized set of political parties. I suspect that in the Egyptian case, the Brotherhood includes people that are relatively moderate and might want to use Turkey as the model for an Islamist society, but there are definitely people that are much more extreme and that see Iran as a guidepost. And I think one of the dangers is that just like the Khomeini and the Iranian clerics did following the Iranian Revolution in 1979, they're all talking the language of democracy and moderation, but once they get into power, it's just not clear how they're going to behave.
As is the case frequently, as you point out in your book, once people get into power, we're not sure how they're going to behave.
Well, and again, this is why something like the rule of law is critical, because the essence of a modern system is that there's some kind of balance, that you have a powerful state, but the state has to act according to predictable rules, and that's what we mean by having a rule of law. It's relatively easy in the modern world to hold elections. What's much harder to do is to actually create a working rule of law where all of the elites, all of the powerful political actors in the country actually believe that they have to behave according to the same rules that affect everyone else. And that's actually one of the slowest sets of institutions to develop over time.
Is this system of accountability, you mean?
Well, it's different. Voting is a form of accountability, and clearly you can have poorly organized elections and lack of accountability. But even in the absence of elections, having a rule of law is important because it is a form of limiting power and making it more predictable. And so I think that you need both accountability through elections and you need a strong independent judiciary and politicians, basically, that are willing to abide by what the courts tell them the limits of their power are.
You know, I want to go back and look at your historic look as well across human history, which is what you did in this book, The Origins of Political Order. But before we do that, one of the things that I feel like a lot of political scientists are really leaving out of the democratic equation and could be one of the sources of decay are actually the citizens themselves and the ability and the willingness to understand policy issues so that they can make informed choices. I mean, we look at the United States today and we see some choices that are made that are quite puzzling.
Yes, that's for sure.
And many of us are quick to blame the media for not really providing any depth and really any substance politically. Perhaps also we can look at the educational systems. I'm not sure, but ultimately I always say that this must fall at the feet of the voters.
Well, it does, ultimately. I think that actually it's easy to blame the media, but both the media and politicians actually follow, you know, I think it's in their interest to follow voter preferences. And voters want contradictory things. They don't want to pay taxes, but they also want to have services. And so you can't have both of those simultaneously. So I think that's a lot of the problem. I think that in many respects, the growth of the internet and more cable TV channels and all of the improvements in communications technology, in a sense, have had this paradoxical impact where you can end up just talking to people who agree with you. And this leads not just to the growth of a particular or entrenching of a certain mindset, but even facts become things that you can bounce around and not have to challenge. It's one thing to disagree over the interpretation of facts, but if different, you know, parts of the ideological spectrum just have a completely different take on what actually happened in the world, then I think you're really in trouble. And I think the idea of democratic deliberation gets much more problematic.
Let's talk a bit about all of the various means of decay, democratic decay. There are many that you talked about going into this rut. You talk about going back to this system of patrimony.
Yeah.
Looking over history, and you looked over a vast history, where did you see that happening and how did the decay occur?
Well, I think there are really two main mechanisms by which this occurs. One is what I call patrimonialism, and basically what that means is that the basic mode by which people are genetically programmed to interact with each other is to favor friends and family. And there's nothing wrong with that. Everybody does it. But in politics, we hopefully have moved beyond just friends and family to treating people impersonally as citizens, you know, where there's a kind of equality of treatment and respect. And I think what tends to happen in many societies over time is particularly people that are powerful or wealthy or have high status are able to capture parts of the government and use it for their own purposes. The other means by which we get political decay, I think, is just through the rigidity of institutions. People create institutions to help themselves organize life, but then they begin to worship the particular form of the institution itself, and when circumstances change, they're not able to adjust the institution to meet the changing circumstances. And I think both of those contribute to the dysfunctionality of political systems over time.
It sounds a bit like you're describing the United States Supreme Court.
Well, not just the United States Supreme Court. One of my chapters is on France before the French Revolution, old regime France, in which the French government actually literally sold public offices because it was so desperate for cash. And so it would sell the post of finance minister, and inevitably it would be bought by a rich financier who would then use it to enrich himself. And in fact, you could turn over these offices to your children as part of the ancestral inheritance. And there's a certain eerie resemblance between that and the way that interest groups now operate in Washington, where they capture a certain part of Congress. It's really impossible to dislodge them. And then when you want to reform things, you want to reform health care, you want to close the budget deficit or do any of the things that are necessary for the collective good, these groups really exercise a kind of veto power. And I think we're not really at the stage that old regime France was before the revolution, but you know, it's something that could come if we're not careful about it.
It seemed in part that one of the purposes of your book was to really look at potential decay here in the United States.
Well, the book is actually just the first of two volumes. I don't want to give people the wrong impression because it actually historically doesn't cover things beyond the French and American revolutions. But I think that historical background is important because I believe that in the long run, there is a constant human nature and there's a kind of repetition of historical patterns. And sometimes it's important to understand that this is not the first time, for example, that a political system has decayed or that it's met the challenges of certain forms of corruption or patrimonialism or anything of that sort. That's one of the purposes I had in writing it, is to look at these long historical continuities.
Let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Francis Fukuyama, and the book he has written and is talking about is The Origins of Political Order, From Prehuman Times to the French Revolution. Stay tuned. Let's back up and look at history a little bit. You, all the way to the beginning of human organization, more or less, and said, look, we're social creatures. We have been organizing ourselves in some kind of a social fashion for a very long time. We're not that different from chimpanzees. And one of the distinctions, because chimpanzees also organize themselves and they raid their neighbors, like tribal behavior, they take the female chimpanzees into their own tribe. One of the distinctions, you said, between us and chimpanzees is that they don't have the same capacity for language that has created perhaps a more sophisticated ability to organize oneself. From that to more tribal societies to Denmark, or China, or...
It's a long route. Well, that's right. I think that we are social creatures, and in a sense, there is an amazing amount of continuity between primitive human societies and the way that higher primates organize themselves. And so we're not descended from chimpanzees. We're descended from an ancestor of modern chimpanzees. But there's actually a lot of similar behavior in terms of chimpanzees organizing themselves into status hierarchies. They create, in effect, gangs. They go raiding and killing each other in a very socially organized fashion. But, of course, human beings have language, and they have this ability to reason abstractly, and that creates a much more complex form of organization. And so you get not just tribalism, which depends on a belief in the power of dead ancestors, which chimpanzees don't have, but then you get the state and you know, religious ideas that allow human beings to organize not just a group of 20, 30 relatives, but you know, gigantic societies with millions of people, because we do have ideas that provide a basis for legitimacy for different forms of complex social organization. And so telling that story has to start, I think, with human nature and what we share with certain animals, but it needs to recognize the specifically human characteristics that we bring to this.
And you said when we look at the development of democratic societies, we do need to look at Europe. We need to look at Greece. We need to look at Rome. You mentioned how Denmark went from a very tribal society to a very evolved kind of democratic form. You said we also need to look at China.
Well, that's right. China, its historical contribution, in my view, was it was the first society to create a really modern state, not just a state, but one that recruited people on the basis of a civil service examination, that promoted people on the basis of merit, that tried to create a uniform administration across a very large society. And they did this really beginning in the 3rd century B.C. What the Chinese didn't have and still do not have is a genuine rule of law that limits that power, and then some form of democratic accountability. But the state part of it, they got right, and that's one of the three important components, I think, of any modern political system.
And then in terms of developing rule of law, you look at the role of religion.
Well, that's right, because if the rule of law means socially accepted rules that limit the power of the government to just do whatever it wants, if you think about this historically, those rules do tend to come out of religion. So in ancient Israel or in the Christian West or in the world of Islam or in India under Hinduism, all of those civilizations had a religiously based law and a institutionalized priesthood that interpreted the law that acted as a constraint on political power. Now, obviously, in the West, many people have become secular, but we're still left with the legacy of courts, lawyers, the very basis of civil law systems in continental Europe actually comes out of something called the Justinian Code, which was a compilation of Roman law that was revived by the Catholic Church in the 11th century. And so I think religion really was important in being a limiting factor in constraining rulers.
In terms of the idea of accountability for the political leaders and for the government itself, where did that come from?
Well, it's funny because it's a kind of historical accident. Modern parliamentary democracy had its origins in the survival of a feudal institution. Every country in Europe had a feudal institution called an estate or a parliament or a cortes in Spain or a diet that the king had to go to get permission to raise taxes, to declare war for a number of purposes. And in the early modern period, meaning in the 16th, 17th centuries, you had rulers that tried to undermine the power of these estates, and they were successful almost everywhere. They created absolutist political systems in Spain, in France, in Russia, in other countries. The one place where this didn't happen was in England, where the parliament, the English parliament, was strong and cohesive enough that it fought a civil war with one king, it beheaded him, it displaced a second king in the so-called Glorious Revolution, and out of that came modern parliamentary government, where the king acknowledged that it was parliament that was really sovereign and not himself. And that's really, less than 100 years later, the principle of legitimacy through consent of the people and no taxation without representation then become the basis of American democracy. And so, in a sense, we owe our modern, you know, Congress and legislative forms to the survival of a feudal institution called the parliament.
And so finally, what I think I'd like to close with is this bit you wrote in the last part of your book that talked about ideas being the source of really the next wave of what form of governance we have, that ideas are what shape whether we go into a better developed democracy or if we go into decay. Talk about this a bit.
Well, ideas are really important because that's what motivates people to get out into the streets and you know, demonstrate or demand participation and the like. But in human mentality, ideas also are kind of sticky. You know, people, once they see the world in a certain way, they have a hard time modifying that, even if the world has turned out to be different than they expected. So I think that, you know, that people become very attached to a certain way of seeing the world and then unwilling to take in new empirical information that should tell them that actually things are a little bit more complex than they thought.
And I think that's a perfect place to close. Francis Fukuyama is the author of The Origins of Political Order, From Prehuman Times to the French Revolution. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
What are the trends and the consequences of an increasingly unequal society? Stay tuned.
There's no way out of here when you come in, you're in for good. There was no promise made, the part you played, the chance you took. There are no boundaries set, the time and yet you wasted still.
welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Income inequalities are one of many disparities facing Americans. What are the trends and what are the consequences of an increasingly unequal society? We are joined by three experts. Lane Kenworthy is professor of sociology and political science at the University of Arizona. He is the author of numerous publications, including the books Progress for the Poor and Egalitarian Capitalism. Miles Korak is professor of economics with the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Ottawa in Canada. He is author of publications, including Generational Income Mobility in North America and Europe. Sylvia Allegretto is a labor economist and the deputy chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She is author of numerous publications, including The State of Working America and most recently, The State of Working America's Wealth. Take a look at a very fundamental premise that the U.S. was ostensibly built upon, and that is the notion that the U.S. is built on equality. And there's a lot of beliefs around what equality is and the discrepancy between what people think and what the reality is. What exactly do we mean when we talk about equality or inequality? Are we talking about political equality, socioeconomic, opportunity, mobility? Lane Kenworthy, let's start with you.
I think the tradition in the U.S. has been to think of, when people think of equality, they usually contrast it immediately to opportunity. If you're asked a question along the lines of, well, how important do you think it is to have less inequality, lots of Americans, if they think it's applying to opportunity, will say, well, that's very important to me. If they think it's applying to incomes or wealth, the responses tend to be much more muted. Historically, it's been a very strong strain of social or cultural inequality or equality. That is to say, among Americans, even though there's a great deal of income inequality and wealth inequality compared to other rich nations, Americans like to think of themselves as not too unequal in terms of social distance or mannerisms or ways of dressing and speaking. And you can see that really explicitly on the campaign trail. American presidential candidates nowadays tend to wear khakis and jeans and open collar shirts. They don't wear ties anymore. This is the men, of course. And they try to speak in a way that sounds as plain folky as possible. And, you know, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and people like this dress in the same way that many college students do. So there's this other way of thinking about equality where a lot of Americans very much want to think of their country this way, and I think for the most part do think we're a fairly egalitarian nation. Then coming back to opportunity, this is the thing that I think Americans tend to think is most important of all. For example, you can glean, I think, from public opinion surveys as well as just lots of anecdotes, that many Americans don't think it's such a big problem if there's an awful lot of inequality of income or wealth, as long as they think opportunity is plentiful. I think that's actually a non-trivial part of the reason. It's certainly not the only reason, but it's an important part of the reason why there's been this sudden surge of interest in inequality, is that some people think not only have incomes, maybe wealth, especially incomes for those at the top, gotten so far above everyone else, but there's a sense that this has real implications for opportunity for people and especially their kids further down the income ladder.
Miles Korak?
Well, I very much agree with the way that Lane has sort of described the situation. I think certainly historically, the defining metaphor of the United States was one associated with equality of opportunity. The idea that one's life chances and the long-run adult payments of children really depended upon talents and energies and motivation, that the labor market and other social institutions were in some sense open to all with the capacity to seize these opportunities.
In terms of this particular area, opportunity specifically, this is an area that you have looked at. And it seems from your research, it's a bit of a myth.
Often that's sort of described in terms of the American dream. And we have to be careful how we parse that. Many people still want to move to the United States. In an absolute sense, this is a rich country, a very dynamic economy, in which people can, in fact, better themselves. And that part of the American dream, I think, is still there and still vibrant. And it's very clear by immigration flows. But the kind of research I focused on is a little bit more subtle than that, referring to one's place in the income distribution, particularly if children were born in families with significant incomes above the average. Does that in some sense predestine them to also become children who adults who are rich? Similarly, we could ask, do relatively poor people end up raising children who have a tendency to become relatively poor? And if you look at the data, I mean, broad group of children raised in middle-class families do quite well, and the idea of equality of opportunity is there. And where the U.S. perhaps is a little bit distinct concerns the capacities of rich people to raise children who become rich and poor people who see their children stuck at the bottom. Overall, on average, it appears that there's a little bit more stickiness in outcomes, or the relationship between family background and child outcomes is a little bit more sticky in the U.S. than in other countries that it might traditionally compare itself to. But in part, it depends upon how we look at that. So it's really important to focus on what's happening in the extremes of the income distribution and being conscious that we're talking about relative positions in the income distribution as opposed to absolute differences in economic well-being.
Sylvia Allegretto, let's bring you in. You've looked at this in terms of wages as well as certain sectors such as teachers and with regards to race. What are you finding?
I'd just like to step back on a larger narrative for a second, and that's to say kind of what we're talking about here, this idea of really the mobility and our system that's based on equal opportunity, and I do think most are equal opportunity for all, not equal outcomes, and the fact that we have a merit-based system that folks kind of get what they deserve. What we're really kind of deconstructing is here is the tenets or, you know, the ideals of the American dream. And these are tightly interwoven to the fabric of our lives and our expectations. And I think what we're doing here and what kind of Occupy Wall Street has been doing is kind of positing that these threads, you know, the threads of the folklore must be unwoven and examined against reality, which is what the professors and I do, look at real data. And we need to do that if we're going to change our course and to move forward and towards instead of further away from our ideals. So when you talk about this idea of mobility and opportunity, if we do have, for instance, the merit-based system that most people think that we have, that people get the just rewards that they deserve, and if you don't, it's your fault. If you do, it's to your credit. And that system said there should be no difference. There should be no really vast differences based on race or class or gender. But we know from many, many studies in sociology and economic and political that there are vast differences. Not only at where people start, we call that kind of inequality at the starting gate, but where people end up. And, you know, that points to what the professor was just talking about with his data, saying, you know, people are kind of stuck in the U.S. where they began life. It's a very much a determinant of where you end up from is where you started.
I wonder if we could get some quantification into this conversation. Sylvia Allegretto, is that something you can do?
Yeah, one of the big points that came out recently from the Congressional Budget Office was this earnings report, after-tax inflation-adjusted earnings climbed by like 275% for the top 1% of earners from 1979 through, I think it was 2008 or something like that. Well, the increase was about, you know, 18% for the bottom 20% of earners. So it's not just that we have very rich people. We always have had very rich people. But it is the case that the rich people are getting much richer at a much faster pace compared to, you know, the increases in everybody else's income. So I think what we're saying, I don't think Americans, by and large, they don't begrudge riches, especially if a rising tide is lifting all boats. If you believe that we need, for instance, tax cuts for the wealthy because we're all going to do better, I don't think most Americans begrudge that. But I think what's happened, we've just had a 30-year experiment with that, and we see now that it's probably more the case that the rich are not getting richer and taking us with them. The rich are getting richer at the expense of everybody else. And I think that's where the big problem comes in.
Lane Kenworthy, I want to go back to you because of this question about the rising tide lifting all boats. It's something you've looked at whether or not the better economy actually affects all people in the positive way or in any equal sort of a way. What have you found?
I think this is a really important question. And I think it's key to stress. So one of the things Sylvia just mentioned is that, I guess, it's earnings for those at the low end of the distribution have risen by a very small amount. That's true, and it's also the case for household incomes. It's the case for other measures, too. If you look at consumption, for for example. So all of these measures, they'll differ a little bit, but they're all telling essentially the same story, which is for people in the bottom quarter of the distribution or even in the bottom half, there's been very little income, earnings, consumption, arguably broader well-being, although that's a little more contested, gain over the last generation, despite an awful lot of economic growth. Our economy hasn't grown quite as fast as it did in the several decades right after World War II, but it's grown quite rapidly. And yet, to put it in kind of crude or colloquial terms, not a lot of that growth has trickled down to those in the lower half of the distribution. And there's where we, I think, ought to be, among other reasons, worried about this rise in income inequality, because that's a big part of the reason. It's not the only reason why this has happened, but it's a big part of the reason. So the amount of income in the economy goes up, but if a larger and larger share is going to those at the very top, that leaves inevitably less for those in the middle and at the lower end. And that's essentially what's happened. Now, it's not automatically true. So one objection or one way of thinking about this might be to say, well, look, that's just the new reality in the new economy. It's a different world now than it was back in the 50s, 60s, and early 1970s. It's a much more competitive, much more internationalized economy. We have a very different system of corporate governance now, so you don't have shareholders who simply want a little long-term appreciation in the price of a stock and maybe some steady flow of dividends. Now they insist on constant, rapid improvement in profits. We have a lot of technological change, and all of these things arguably both put pressure on management to control costs in a way that just didn't exist before, and also make life tougher for those with limited skills because they face more competition both abroad and also within this country, and additionally from machines. So maybe that's just the way life is. And yet, when I look across the rich countries, I don't see the same pattern replicated everywhere. There are a few other countries where things have played out more or less similarly to the way they have here, not quite as extreme as here. But that is to say, there's been economic growth, fairly solid economic growth, but also rising inequality, and consequently not very much improvement in wages or incomes for households in the lower half, especially in the bottom 10%. But those countries are actually a minority. More than half of the 20 or so rich countries around the world have seen a very different process, much like we did in the 1950s and 60s, where a good chunk of the economic growth does trickle down to households in the lower half. It happens in various ways. It's through a mix of earnings, that is to say increases in earnings, which can come both from more employment and higher wages, and also from a steady increase in government transfers. So part of the population in any rich country inevitably depends on government transfers, whether it's pensions or unemployment insurance or sickness or disability payments or social assistance, what we usually call TANF and food stamps, that go to the very poorest who aren't working. Countries face a choice about when the economies are growing, do we increase the generosity of these benefits a little bit so that those who are dependent on them can more or less keep up with everyone else, or do we not? And for the most part, with the exception of Social Security and the Earned Income Tax Credit, we in the United States really haven't done that. And that's one of the things that separates us from the other countries that I looked at.
Miles Korak?
When I think about inequality, I think it's helpful to think of the different causes. And there are probably three different ways of understanding growing inequality in the United States and in some other countries. Certainly first, what's happening at the lower end. The return to low-skilled work, for example, has fallen tremendously, and this is no surprise to anyone who's versed in the decline of manufacturing and the decline of certain institutions like unions. And so there's less growth in the incomes of people with lower levels of skills and education. And that's what's preventing the lower end from moving up. At the same time, globalization and technical change have really changed in a fundamental way. And again, this is more so in the U.S. than in other countries. The returns to higher education, and particularly education from certain schools and certain fields, so that the top 20% or so have seen significant increases in their labor market outcomes. Now, both of those factors imply growing inequality across the entire distribution. But if you lay on top of that the third force, and that has to do with the growing share of earnings and incomes that accrue to the very, very top, and there's good research documenting with very good data that the total share of earnings made in the U.S. and in other Anglophone-speaking countries that accrue to the top 1%, and even less, the top 0.1%, have really ballooned quite dramatically since the 1980s. And that has been a very important factor in increasing overall measures of inequality. Now, this is where I think you get into an interesting discussion about what to do about this. And if there is a good deal of equality of opportunity, if children raised at any point in the income distribution can aspire to become anything else or all that they could be, then we might not be as concerned about these types of inequality. And I think for a long time there's been a certain disconnect in the American psyche, if you will, where we accept, as the other commentators have pointed out, a certain amount of inequality at a point in time because we believe that there is mobility over time and over generations, that even if I am not able to see a growing standard of living for my family, I can aspire for that, for my children to see that. And that belief has sort of allowed the United States or the broad population to accept a good deal more inequality than in other countries. And I think that disconnect or that perception is starting to change. So earlier you called for some facts. I mean, it is, I think, well documented that if you were born in the top 10% in the United States, or the children born to people in the top 10%, one quarter of that group will grow up to be top 10%ers in the next generation. Similarly, if you were born in the bottom 10%, your chances are almost 25% of staying in the bottom in adulthood. So I think the perception is changing about the degree of opportunity, and particularly I think there has to be a concern about the growing share in the top 1%, whether that is merited, whether that influences how you structure other institutions, be it transfer programs, be it the financing of education systems, be it the structuring of political mechanisms for change. And that can be a very, I think, corrosive effect of inequality if it tends to become stratified and built in because of the rise in top sharing.
I just want to remind listeners that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, and we are speaking with Miles Corak, Lane Kenworthy, and Sylvia Allegretto. Stay tuned. I'd like to think a bit about public policies and their roles. We talked a bit about globalization and technology and those sorts of things. What are these other policies that have been key in building this divide? We've all read the Pearson and Hacker work. We know there is a political system in place that restricts the political equality. I'm curious about how that translates into socioeconomic inequality as well.
Well, I think it's a great question. And I think it's, you know, one of the most peculiar things that I talk about is the people that are using government, those telling you that government is not the solution, that government cannot be a solution, that government is the problem. And this has been a mantra for decades now, and it's really been ratcheted up recently with the presidential race going on. But this idea that government is not your friend, government's not the solution, that basically we have to have this blind faith in free market ideals, and if you don't, you know, they question your patriotism, your religion. It's intertwined with so much, these free market ideals. Because as they're telling you that the government is not part of the solution, that's what they're using. They're using the government. And this is basically a vicious cycle that's been going on and ratcheting up over a 30-year period, this vicious cycle of wealth. And the idea that wealth, and we know what's happening now with Citizens United, the self-perpetuating cycle of the rich buying politicians and our political access via lobbyists, for instance, and in turn they get their payback via policies that beget them even more wealth and more power. And this is all pretty much done through the political process and through policies. For instance, why the top marginal tax rates fall from like 94% in 1945 or so down to 35%. They would have you believe that this is came from on high, from some pro-capitalist free market deity. Well, no, this is just policy that was bought and sold by the one percenters. This is a purposeful policy that turned out exactly the way they wanted it. And even more than that, they use it as something that we argue about, should we let the Bush tax rates expire or not, when they all know that the real action is in the historically low capital gains rate that now happens to be 15%. Again, this idea that everything that helps business is just from the free market enterprise and cannot be questioned. But when you start talking about, wow, we need to have more unions, we have to level the playing field, we need to pass the Employee Free Choice Act, or we need to increase the minimum wage, we need to increase job quality, so that not only wages increase, but you get some kind of benefits in retirement, health care, and retirement security. As soon as you do that, it's no longer the free market. So this idea that very few people is playing the game and playing it very well, as they're telling the rest of us, just don't get involved.
I'd like to also be able to look at what the effect of inequality is on society. Lane Kenworthy, you especially have looked at what people desire, and most people do desire some kind of equality, partly as desire for fairness. But there are other reasons, in addition to just our ideals, to have equality, because they actually have effects. What might some of those effects be?
I'll start by saying I think it's worth separating two classes or groups of these effects. So one hypothesis is that if income inequality goes up, then it's going to accentuate inequality of various other social and economic outcomes. So, for example, you might see more inequality between the rich and the poor and the likelihood that their kids go to college or graduate from college. You might see more inequality between the rich and the poor in various health measures, whether it's their subjective feelings about their health or life expectancy or infant mortality or things like this. And I think, although social scientists are still looking into this, I don't think there's very much disagreement that when inequality goes up, at least to the degree that it has, like in a country like the U.S., which is quite a large increase over the last generation, I don't think there's much disagreement that it will have those types of effects. We can see in the data that there has, just for example, been rising inequality among income groups in life expectancy and in the likelihood that your kid will graduate from college. Just to put some numbers on that briefly, among kids in the United States who grew up in the 60s and 70s, if your parents were in the bottom quarter of the income distribution, there was only about a 5% chance you'd graduate from college. If they were in the richest quarter, there was about a 35% chance. Among those growing up in the 80s and 90s, if your parents were in the bottom quarter, so the bottom 25% of the income distribution, you were a little more likely. Of course, there was a massive increase in all Americans going to college, especially in the 60s. So you're a little more likely, but it only goes up to about 9%. So it went from 5% to 9%. That's not really much of a change given the huge expansion in universities around the United States. Among those in the top 25%, it went from about 35% up to about 55%. So a big increase, more than half of kids from families in the upper quarter of the income distribution now going to college compared to just a third before, and then very little increase for those at the bottom. Okay, so that's one example. Now, there's another possibility, which is that if income inequality goes up, you'll see the average level of things like health or education outcomes go down. And so the idea here is that a rise in income inequality is bad for almost everyone in society, except for maybe those at the very tip top. And that, I think, is a much more controversial, less widely accepted proposition, in part because we haven't researched it a lot. There's a book by a couple of British epidemiologists, Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, called The Spirit Level, that's gotten a fair amount of attention, especially in the UK, which argues that there are actually quite strong effects of this type. So inequality is bad, income inequality is bad for life expectancy, bad for education, bad for trust, bad for prevalence of crime, and a host of other social and economic outcomes. I'm doing some research on this myself with Christopher Jenks, but we're right in the middle of it, and so I guess I can say that we're not finding nearly the kinds of strong effects that Wilkinson and Pickett did, but it's a little too early for us to be certain. But I'll just say that if that does turn out to be the case, if Wilkinson and Pickett, and they're not alone here, others, Robert Frank, an economist at Cornell, has made this type of argument about middle-class debt, for example. If this turns out to be right, it's a much stronger reason to worry about income inequality. I think there's already plenty strong reason on fairness grounds, and because I think it's really unfortunate if inequality of opportunity for health or education, if that increases as a result of rising income inequality. But if the this other type of effect also is present, then that's even more reason to worry.
Miles Corak.
I certainly agree with the tone of the discussion and with Lane's summary of a broad sweep of the literature. The most pervasive thing I think about equality, or the most biggest threat we have, is that it erodes opportunity. And it can do that by restructuring our institutions. One of the most important institutions is the education system. So if the education system becomes less progressive, as was just sort of described, if it's financed on a very narrow property tax base, and if the quality varies in a way that's regressive across the income distribution, you're going to see opportunity erode over time. And that's something I think in the long run that we should all worry about.
All right. Well, let me leave it there and thank the three of you for joining us. Lane Kenworthy, professor of sociology and political science at University of Arizona and author of numerous books, including Progress for the Poor and Egalitarian Capitalism. Miles Corak, professor of economics at the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs at University of Ottawa in Canada and author of numerous publications, including three edited books, the most recent, Generational Income, Mobility in North America and Europe. Sylvia Allegretto, labor economist and deputy chair at the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at University of California, Berkeley, and research associate at the Economic Policy Institute. Among her publications are The State of Working America and most recently The State of Working America's Wealth. Thank you all so very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and special thanks to Ankina Aghasian, Melissa Ciprin, who helped produce today's show. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed any part of the show, go to kpfk.org and click on the audio archives. You can also keep up with us at scholarcircle.org or armudian.com, or follow me on Twitter at armudian.